From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I'm going to do it whether the women like it or not. I'm going to protect them.
He does not believe women should have the agency and authority to make decisions about their own bodies.
Kamala Harris blasts Donald Trump for vowing to protect women whether they like it or not. At the same time, he calls for Republican Liz Cheney to be shot in the face. We'll get response from the nation's Amy Littlefield and talk about 10 states with abortion rights on the ballot. We'll also look at House and Senate races across the country with journalist John Nichols in Wisconsin, including the red state of Nebraska, where independent candidate, UAW-backed labor activist Dan Osborne could oust his Republican opponent. And what's that little secret between Trump and Johnson?
We got to get the congressman elected, and we got to get the senators elected, because we can take the Senate pretty easily. And I think with our little secret, we're going to do really well with the House, right? Our little secret is having a big impact. He and I have a secret. We'll tell you what it is when the race is over.
We'll speak with Ellie Mistel about how House Speaker Mike Johnson could help install Trump as president through a contingent election in which the House, not the Electoral College, determines the president. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Gaza, Israeli airstrikes have killed at least 95 Palestinians since Thursday morning, as Israel intensifies its attacks on Deir al-Balah and the Nusayrat refugee camp in northern Gaza. The Associated Press has revealed a shocking story about a Palestinian ambulance worker who was transporting a corpse wrapped in a bloody sheet. Once he arrived at Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir al-Balah, he learned the body was of his own mother, who'd been killed in an Israeli airstrike. Meanwhile, Doctors Without Borders has confirmed one of its own orthopedic surgeons, Dr. Mohammed Obaid, has been detained by Israeli forces along with other medical staff at Kamal Adwan Hospital. In the occupied West Bank, the death toll from an Israeli raid on the Nur Shams refugee camp has risen to at least five. Israeli troops destroyed roads, water infrastructure, and a health clinic run by UNRWA, the UN refugee organization. UNRWA said their office was a hub to deliver services to 14,000 Palestinian refugees in the camp. Israeli forces also reportedly detained and beat a number of Palestinians during the deadly raid. One Palestinian, named Osama Shaheen, said Israeli troops wrote numbers on the forehead of each prisoner.
At the time of dawn prayers exactly, they raided the house. They broke down the door and damaged everything in the house. Nothing was left in the house. I was beaten from the moment I left the house to when we went to Majnune. They brought me back here. All sorts of beatings, on my chest, on my head. It was severe. Each one got a number on his forehead, and in the army jeep, everyone there hits you. Everyone hits you. Most of the beating is to the head, mostly to the head.
The Washington Post's reporting, Israel's bombing campaign in southern Lebanon has now damaged or destroyed nearly 5,900 buildings near the Israeli border, about a quarter of all buildings in the area. Lebanon's Ministry of Health reported six medics were killed Thursday in Israel's ongoing attacks. Israel bombed the southern suburbs of Beirut overnight, destroying dozens of more buildings. Lebanon's Prime Minister Najib Mikati blasted Israel over the latest attack, saying it's a sign that Israel's rejecting efforts to secure a ceasefire. Meanwhile, Hezbollah responded with rocket attacks on northern Israel Thursday that killed seven people, including four agricultural workers from Thailand. In Britain, pro-Palestinian activists have called off protests targeting Barclays after the banking giant revealed it had sold its shares in Elbit Systems, Israel's largest weapons company. The British group Palestine Action had organized over 50 direct action protests targeting Barclays over the past year. In election news, Kamala Harris campaigned in Arizona Thursday and blasted Donald Trump for saying he's going to protect women, whether the women like it or not.
And this is not the first time he has told us who he is. He does not believe women should have the agency and authority to make decisions about their own bodies. This is the same man who said women should be punished for their choices. He simply does not respect the freedom of women or the intelligence of women to know what's in their own best interest and make decisions accordingly.
During Harris's speech in Phoenix, Arizona, she was repeatedly interrupted by pro-Palestinian protesters. Donald Trump was also in Arizona Thursday, where he campaigned with Tucker Carlson. Trump suggested former Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney should face a firing squad. Cheney and her father, former Vice President Dick Cheney, have both backed Harris in the race.
And I don't blame him for sticking with his daughter, but his daughter is a very dumb individual, very dumb. She's a radical war hawk. Let's put her with a rifle standing there with 9 barrels shooting at her, okay? Let's see how she feels about it. You know, when the guns are trained on her face.
Liz Cheney responded by writing, quote, "This is how dictators destroy free nations. They threaten those who speak against them with death. We cannot entrust our country and our freedom to a petty, vindictive, cruel, unstable man who wants to be a tyrant," unquote. Donald Trump's heading to Dearborn, Michigan today, to the nation's largest Arab-majority city, where many former Biden voters have vowed not to back Harris over her support for Israel's war on Gaza. Harris has not yet campaigned in Dearborn. Earlier this week, former President Bill Clinton campaigned for Harris in Michigan and sparked outcry after he said Israel was being, quote, forced to kill civilians in Gaza.
Hamas makes sure that they're shielded by civilians. They'll force you to kill civilians if you want to defend yourself.
Spain has declared 3 days of national mourning after the death toll from devastating flash flooding soared to 158. Most of the deaths were in Valencia, where flooding uprooted trees, downed power lines, demolished bridges and roads, and left hundreds of cars strewn about like toys half buried in the mud. The disaster struck as unprecedented storms brought a year's worth of rainfall in just 8 hours.
Well, it's all destroyed. Shops, supermarkets, schools, cars, it's all destroyed. These caravans come from the 27th neighborhood, almost in Valencia. They went all the way down until here, and just here on the right, there's a boat. It has been incredible, mind-blowing.
Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez is warning devastation caused by flash flooding is not finished, as Spain's weather agency warned a fresh round of storms will bring more heavy rain today. Climate scientists warn human activity is driving global heating that makes extreme weather events more frequent and more destructive. Democracy Now! Will be in Baku, Azerbaijan, to cover the UN climate summit in a few weeks. Papua New Guinea's leaders have withdrawn from this month's COP29 UN climate summit after slamming pledges by the world's biggest polluters as empty talk. Foreign Minister Justin Klotchenko said, quote, "We will no longer tolerate empty promises and inaction while our people suffer the devastating consequences of climate change. If we must cut down our forests to sustain ourselves and develop our economy, so be it," unquote. Papua New Guinea says it'll instead seek to forge bilateral climate agreements with other nations. North Korea's Foreign Minister Cho Sun-hui is visiting Moscow as about 10,000 North Korean forces have arrived near Ukraine's border to fight alongside Russian troops. Meanwhile, North Korea test-fired an intercontinental ballistic missile Thursday, demonstrating its ability to launch nuclear attacks that could reach the mainland, the United States. Former Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte has admitted under oath he oversaw a death squad of gangsters he used to target people while he served as mayor of the southern city of Davao. Duterte made the admission during testimony Monday to a Philippine Senate inquiry into widespread extrajudicial police and vigilante killings carried out under Duterte's so-called war on drugs.
Meron akong death squad.
I have a death squad. A death squad. Seven of them. But they are the police. They were gangsters. I command one of the gangsters, kill that, because if you don't, I will kill you.
A United Nations report found at least 8,600 people were killed in the drug war unleashed by Duterte, with some estimates suggesting the true toll could be 3 times higher. The International Criminal Court in The Hague is investigating Duterte for possible crimes against humanity committed under his rule. Botswana's president has conceded defeat after his long-ruling Botswana Democratic Party lost its parliamentary majority for the first time since Botswana won its independence from Britain in 1966. The president, Mokgweetsi Masisi, had been seeking a second five-year term in Wednesday's election. Opposition leader Duma Boko of the Umbrella for Democratic Change Party is expected to become Botswana's new president. And in Brazil, two former police officers who confessed to assassinating Rio de Janeiro City Councilwoman Marielle Franco and her driver in 2018 were sentenced Thursday to long prison terms. Rani Lessa, who admitted to firing the fatal shots, was sentenced to nearly 79 years. Elcio de Queiroz, who drove the getaway car, received a nearly 60-year sentence. Following Thursday's verdict, Marielle's sister, the black activist, journalist and educator Aniele Franco, spoke out. Since last year, she has served as Brazil's Minister of Racial Equality.
Since the beginning, we said we would not stop until justice was made. It was a lot of nights, days, years, taking care of my parents. Yesterday I said it, and today I repeat it. Marielle's biggest legacy to the country is the evidence that women, black people who live in slums, when they get to positions, they deserve to remain alive.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. Just days away from Election Day, Kamala Harris campaigned in Arizona Thursday and blasted Donald Trump for saying he's going to protect women, quote, whether the women like it or not. Harris spoke from Phoenix just hours before Trump also made an appearance in Arizona as both candidates make a final push in battleground states.
And Donald Trump's not done. Did everyone hear what he just said yesterday? That he will do what he wants, quote, and here's where I'm going to quote, whether the women like it or not. And we must vote because this is the thing. You know, there's a saying that you got to listen to people when they tell you who you are, who they are. And this is not the first time he has told us who he is. He does not believe women should have the agency and authority to make decisions about their own bodies. This is the same man who said women should be punished for their choices. He simply does not respect the freedom of women or the intelligence of women to know what's in their own best interest and make decisions accordingly.
Donald Trump was also in Arizona Thursday, where he campaigned with Tucker Carlson. Trump suggested former Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney should face a firing squad. Cheney and her father, former Vice President Dick Cheney, have both backed Harris in the race.
And I don't blame him for sticking with his daughter, but his daughter is a very dumb individual, very dumb. She's a radical war hawk. Let's put her with a rifle standing there with nine barrels shooting at her, okay? Let's see how she feels about it. You know, when the guns are trained on her face.
This comes as voters in at least 10 states will decide on historic ballot measures that would enshrine abortion rights in their state constitutions, including in Arizona, Nevada, Florida, South Dakota, Nebraska, and Missouri, which is one of the nation's strictest abortion bans that went into effect after the conservative majority Supreme Court gutted Roe v. Wade in 2022. The Associated Press reports proponents of the abortion rights ballot measures have raised over $160 million, nearly six times more than what anti-abortion groups have fundraised to fight the initiatives. For more, we go to Boston, where we're joined by Amy Littlefield, independent journalist who covers reproductive health and abortion access at The Nation, where her latest piece is headlined, Peering into the Minds of the Moderate White Women Who Might Just Save Us from Trump. Amy, welcome back to Democracy Now! Why don't we start off by talking about the violence? Let's start off by talking about what President Trump said about protecting women, whether they want it or not. And then this interview with Tucker Carlson said that Liz Cheney should be shot with barrels trained on her face.
I mean, Amy, I think I actually have a more generous interpretation of Trump's comments about, you know, protecting women, whether they like it or not, than many critics. I have to say, I think what Trump said from the stage is actually a very succinct and clear definition of patriarchy. I mean, feminist theorists couldn't have dreamed of putting it so succinctly and so clearly, right? He is laying out the bargain that white patriarchy has offered to white women in this country since the colonization of this country, right? It is so clear. He is saying, white women, we will protect you from brown and black men, right? That was the context of that quote. It was about, we're going to protect women from at the border. We're going to protect women in suburbs and cities and farms from this imagined threat of black and brown men who are coming to get them, right? And all we demand in exchange for that protection is your submission. That's been the bargain of patriarchy, right? And it's coming at a time, of course, when women's rights have been vaporized and the Supreme Court, thanks to Donald Trump, has overturned Roe v. Wade. And so, you know, to me, again, I think gender theorists should be studying this quote because it is such a distilled expression of exactly what patriarchy is and exactly what the racist bargain that it has offered to white women throughout our country's history is, right? And so I think for me, the defining question of this election is whether white women, who are the largest voting bloc in this country, 38% of voters in this country are white women, and they have gone for Donald Trump over the Democratic candidate in the last two presidential elections. And to me, the defining question of this election, which is the first since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, is whether white women are going to punish the man who took away their rights and say no to this racist bargain that the Republican Party is offering them. And that's what I'll be watching on Election Day.
And we're going to talk about those abortion initiatives around the country and how they got on the how they got there to begin with, the grassroots movements. But I wanted to stick for a moment with this issue of Trump calling for Liz Cheney to be shot with guns trained on her face. This week, also, Fox News commentator Jesse Waters threatened to divorce his wife, Emma, if he found out she voted for Kamala Harris.
And if I found out Emma was going into the voting booth and pulling the lever for Harris, that's the same thing as having an affair. That, to me...
Oh, my God. Let him finish. Jesse.
That violates the sanctity of our marriage.
Preach on, yes.
What else is she keeping from me?
Exactly.
Why would she have been lying about?
Have you threatened her?
Why would she lie to you?
Oh, they want me to tease.
Why would she do that and then vote Harris? Why would she say she was voting
Trump and then voting Harris?
And I caught her, and then she said, I lied to you for the last four years.
So you admit you intimidated
It's people. Over, Emma. That would be oh, D-Day.
So that's Jesse Waters on Fox. In fact, it was Liz Cheney who told women across the country, don't tell your husbands that you're going to vote for Kamala Harris, but, you know, you've got the privacy of the polling booth.
Amy, I'm a little mad at you for playing those two clips at me back to back when I don't have a bucket here to vomit in. But I just want to say off the bat, I mean, this is the same Jesse Waters who, in fact, did have an affair and cheat on his wife, and she divorced him over that. So I don't know. There's something deeply psychological going on here. But on a more serious note, Amy, I mean, this is something Kylie Chung talks about in her book, Survivor Injustice. There is a phenomenon in this country that we don't know the scope of, which is people who are in abusive relationships whose husbands or abusive partners control the way that they vote. That is a thing. Now, I don't mean to imply that Jesse Waters is in that situation. I don't know the details of his marriage, nor do I want to. But I do think that on a more serious note, this is a real phenomenon, that there are women out there who we know are hiding the way that they're voting from their husbands, right? And we've seen ads about this. We've seen clear statements about it. We've seen women putting stickers in bathroom stalls saying your vote is private. You know, you can vote for Harris no matter what your husband says. And I think what this taps into is a very real phenomenon, which is there is domestic violence-induced voter suppression in this country. You know, Kylie talked to women who said their abusive partners were controlling the way that they voted. And so this is a very real and serious thing. And, you know, I can remember being out knocking doors or observing while canvassers were knocking doors in Kansas when abortion was on the ballot there. And, you know, women answering the door talking about, you know, who were registered Republican, talking about their experiences with IVF and their experiences with reproductive freedom. And so these experiences, especially in the wake of the overturn of Roe v. Wade, might cause women to break with their husbands and to vote for the first black woman president.
Amy Littlefield, let's talk about the abortion ballot initiatives that are in 10 states right now. Begin with Florida and DeSantis on Amendment 4, trying to prevent those who support this ballot initiative from running ads.
I mean, Florida is by far the most high-stakes state where abortion is on the ballot this year. We have abortion on the ballot in 10 states. That's a record for a U.S. election. Florida is a haven state for abortion access in the South, or was until the six-week ban went into effect there. 84,000 abortions in that state before, you know, these restrictions. And so it's crucial to restore abortion access there. We've seen over $100 million raised in this state with this huge momentum behind this campaign to restore abortion access in Florida. And it's obviously terrifying Ron DeSantis, because he's been threatening criminal charges against TV stations for airing ads in favor of the pro-choice amendment, prompting a judge to say it's the First Amendment, stupid. And he's deployed election police to question people who signed the signature, you know, signed the petition to get this amendment on the ballot. So he's used state resources to fight this. We're really seeing Ron DeSantis pulling out all the stops there. At the same time, we're seeing this campaign that knows Republican voters outnumber Democrats in the state by a million. And this is a state that has a very high threshold, 60%, to get an initiative passed. And so there's a huge amount of effort that has to go into persuading Republican and independent voters if this is going to pass. And so what we've seen, you know, I got a hold of some of the internal guidance that the campaign is using. They talk about, you know, don't emphasize DeSantis and Trump. Don't talk about the Republican politicians. Talk about extremist politicians behind this ban, right? They talk about not emphasizing travel stories, but instead emphasizing cases where people's lives were at risk or where there was sexual abuse that caused a pregnancy. And so we're seeing a real attempt to sort of modulate the campaigns in states like Florida to sort of tone it to a moderate frequency to hit voters who are Republican or independent and who may very well be voting for Trump and also voting in favor of abortion rights.
An investigation by ProPublica finds at least two people in Texas died after they were denied reproductive health care due to Texas's abortion ban, which bars doctors from ending the heartbeat of a fetus, even when a pregnancy is non-viable and the life of a pregnant person's at risk. In one case, 28-year-old Giselle Barnica was admitted to a Houston hospital as she began to suffer a miscarriage 17 weeks into her pregnancy. For 40 hours, doctors denied her a simple and urgently needed medical procedure to empty her uterus, which would have prevented the infection that ultimately killed her. She died 3 days after her miscarriage. Can you talk about that report?
Amy, these are just tragic stories, and they keep on coming. This story about Giselle Barnica, who was in a hospital, you know, in pain, suffering for 40 hours, praying that she, you know, be able to return home to her young daughter, and she died, right? And ProPublica has done such a good job laying out how the anti-abortion laws in Texas have led to such confusion and fear among medical providers. The story that they published this morning on Nevaeh Crane, this was an 18-year-old girl who suffers a miscarriage starting on the day of her baby shower. Her mother brings her in to the hospital. She visits three different times and is denied care, delayed, turned away, and eventually dies after the final hospital that she goes to makes her undergo two sonograms to confirm fetal demise. Now, I want to say something that I think ProPublica missed in this story that published today that is hugely important. The hospital where Nevaeh Crane died was a Catholic hospital. It was a Christus facility, which is a Catholic healthcare chain. And Amy, we've spoken before on the show about how Catholic hospitals operate under Catholic religious rules issued by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops that prohibit doctors from performing abortions. This was true before the Dobbs decision. And unfortunately, ProPublica neglected to mention that in their article. And so while I think it's very important to highlight the anti-abortion laws in Texas, which were some of the strictest in the country, and the chilling effect that those laws have on people in life-saving emergencies. It's also important to note that this was far from a perfect system before the Dobbs decision and before these laws went into effect in Texas, and that we had religious hospitals, including Catholic facilities like Texas, that were turning women away in these life-threatening emergencies. And in fact, I and others were doing that reporting before the Dobbs decision. And so we really need to look at the sort of compounding levels in our healthcare system that have all failed women.
And finally, if you can talk about Arizona, how activists got this again on the ballot, and how critical this is, because if people perhaps are not going to the polls to vote for president, but they go to the polls because they want to ensure reproductive health care and access, since they're there, they're going to vote for president. And the question is, will they vote for the one who's against abortion or for abortion? President Trump says if he's president, women will stop thinking about abortion.
Oh, right. Another beautiful patriarchal fantasy foisted upon us. I mean, Arizona, I remember sitting here, Amy, talking to you about Arizona and how they were sending us back to the 19th century, right, with their Civil War era abortion ban. And of course, you know, while that's not in effect anymore, it galvanized the state over the issue of abortion there. And so there's been tremendous momentum in states like Arizona. Activist groups, organizers, people who have mobilized over this issue, getting this on the ballot. Arizona and Nevada, both swing states, both places where abortion is directly on the ballot. And I think another defining question of this election is whether these ballot initiatives, and again, we know ballot initiatives on abortion are popular. All seven times abortion's been on the ballot since Dobbs, it has won. And so I think the question is really whether that popularity of abortion rights extends to Democratic politicians up and down the ballot in these swing states.
Amy Littlefield, I want to thank you for being with us, abortion access correspondent at The Nation, independent journalist who covers reproductive health. 10 states, Montana, Maryland, Colorado, New York, Nebraska, Florida, Missouri, South Dakota, Nevada, and Arizona will have abortion on the ballot. And for many, they've already voted because so many people have voted so far. We'll link to your latest piece, Amy, Peering into the Minds of the Moderate White Women Who Might Just Save Us from Trump. Next up, we look at House and Senate races across the country with journalist John Nichols in Wisconsin. Stay with us. Cure. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to the battleground state of Wisconsin, where both presidential candidates are spending a lot of time. Donald Trump and Kamala Harris held competing rallies in the state Wednesday and returned tonight for two more rallies just miles apart from each other in Milwaukee. On Wednesday in Green Bay, Trump posed in a garbage truck on the airport tarmac amidst Republican criticism of recent comments by President Biden about Trump supporters while responding to a far-right so-called comedian at Trump's weekend rally at Madison Square Garden who called Puerto Rico a floating island of garbage.
How do you like my garbage truck? This truck is in honor of Kamala and Joe Biden.
Meanwhile, Vice President Kamala Harris held a rally in Madison, a city where she spent part of her childhood.
To win. and it's good to be back.
As Harris spoke, a group of peaceful protesters could be heard yelling, "Ceasefire now," from two corners of the arena. Some held a banner reading, "No fundraising for war crimes." This was her response.
We have an opportunity in... Listen, we all want the war in Gaza to end and get the hostages out as soon as possible. And I will do everything in my power to make it heard and known. And everyone has a right to be heard, but right now I am speaking.
Meanwhile, Kamala Harris was greeted with an editorial in the Capital Times headlined, "Welcome home, Kamala. Madison will put you over the top." For more, we're joined in Madison by John Nichols, the nation's national affairs correspondent, who has a new piece headlined, "Trump's not the only top Republican whose fascism is showing." John is the author of more than a dozen books, including his latest, co-written with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, titled, "It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism." John, thanks for joining us. Why don't you start off by talking about Kamala Harris's roots in Madison, Wisconsin, and also lead into the Wisconsin Senate race.
Well, that's a lot of territory and important all around. Thanks for having me on, Amy. And you're right to focus on Wisconsin. It is an incredible battleground tonight. Donald Trump and Kamala Harris literally could have passing motorcades in Milwaukee. But yes, Kamala Harris has roots in Madison, Wisconsin. Her parents were immigrants, a mother from India, a father from Jamaica. They met in California, around Berkeley. They were participants at a club where folks talked about imperialism and colonialism and the changing world at that time. They were both brilliant academics, very progressive activists. And when they got their degrees, from Berkeley, they were looking for places to work, and they traveled around the country. It worked on different campuses at times. They spent a year or so in Madison, Wisconsin, where their young daughter, Kamala, she recalls playing along Lake Mendota. I've been with her at the home where she grew up, and we've talked a lot about her parents. Her father was a pioneering economist in many areas. He was one of the first black faculty members at the University of Wisconsin in the area of economics. Her mother, a very brilliant cancer researcher. And she really did grow up as a very young girl for a time in that Madison environment before her parents ultimately went back to California. And her mother went back. The parents divorced. But Madison is a part of her story.
And her father became the first her father became, right, the first tenured black economist at Stanford in California.
Absolutely. He's a brilliant man. And also one of the most honored economists in the Caribbean, receiving major awards in Jamaica for the work that he did with multiple prime ministers as regards the Jamaican economy. And her mother, too. Just if you look at her academic record and her work on breast cancer, especially. Her parents are a remarkable pair of people. And you know, in politics, we don't explore the family as much sometimes, I suppose. But with Kamala Harris, when you talk to her, what you find is she really does speak it with great depth and passion about her mother, especially, but about her upbringing. And we could go on, we could talk for a very long time about it because it's a good story. And I wrote a lot about it. But you also asked about the Wisconsin Senate race.
Which could determine the balance of the Senate.
Yeah, that's why it's a big deal. Look, here's the reality, and we should put it in perspective. If Kamala Harris is elected president on Tuesday or after a very long count in lots of battleground states, the first question is, how will she be able to govern? Similarly, that's true also, obviously, for Donald Trump. And that comes down to the Senate, because the Senate will confirm cabinet picks. It will confirm judicial picks. There are just so many ways in which the Senate is essential. It's not the only essential body. Obviously, the House matters a great deal. But this fight for control of the Senate is real. And the fact is that the Democrats now have a very narrow, the narrowest majority. They are going to almost certainly lose a seat in West Virginia, the seat that was Joe Manchin's. They are in danger of losing a seat in Montana, which is a state where John Tester has been the senator for a long time. Chester's holding on. I don't necessarily like the analyses that write him off, because he's had a remarkable run of winning in a very, very Republican state. But it's a tough race this year. So the Democrats face the prospect of losing control of the Senate. We can talk in a moment about a couple of other states that are really interesting and might flip that back. But Wisconsin is really central to that, and it's an interesting thing. Tammy Baldwin, the senator from Wisconsin, a reasonably progressive Democrat, has won by pretty good margins in the past. This year, she is facing an onslaught. Her opponent is an incredibly wealthy man who started his campaign by pouring, you know, millions of dollars of his own money in. Now he's received huge infusions of money from national Republican and conservative PACs. And so the airwaves in Wisconsin are filled with brutal attacks on Tammy Baldwin, very, very personal attacks. She is an out lesbian, and they've actually had ads attacking her that show images of her partner and, you know, all sorts of, you know, attacks on her partner as well as her. And so it's become an ugly race in many senses. The polling shows that Tammy Baldwin's still a little bit ahead. And frankly, this seat, as well as a couple others, these are critical, because there's no way that Democrats can control the Senate if Tammy Baldwin loses in Wisconsin, or if Sherrod Brown, frankly, loses in Ohio. And the interesting thing about Baldwin, and one quick thing that I'll note with her, is she's a fascinating figure because, to a greater extent than almost anyone except Bernie Sanders, she has focused on industrial policy, on trade, on economics, on a host of working class issues, on getting pensions back for workers who lose them when a plant closes, things like that. That's still a big part of all her ads. And so Wisconsin becomes a real test of whether somebody who's put a heavy-duty emphasis on those economic issues can overcome a lot of the personal attacks.
I mean, this whole issue of Tammy Baldwin being attacked as an LGBTQ person, and then in Wisconsin, Eric Hovda, her opponent, will not reveal his ultimate wealth, is that right? It's around something like $200 million or more. And then you have Montana, John Tester, up against Tim Sheehy. I remember being on the floor of the Republican convention when Sheehy got up and said, that's right, my name is Sheehy. Those are my pronouns, she, he. There's this obsession around the issue of gender. But then, you know, just as you've interviewed Kamala Harris a number of times through her career, if you can talk about another man you've been following in Nebraska and talk about this very unusual race taking place there.
It's an absolutely fascinating race in Nebraska. I went out there and spent some time this summer and traveled around with Dan Osborne, who is running for the U.S. Senate as an independent against a Republican incumbent, Deb Fischer. And the interesting thing about Dan Osborne is that he's not a career politician by any measure. He's a machinist. He was a leader of the bakery, confectionery, and tobacco and grain millers union at the Kellogg's plant in the Omaha area. He led a strike there. It was a pretty bitter, pretty intense strike, and he got a lot of attention. He was on television quite a bit, and there were people who approached him and said, hey, you know what? You should run for the U.S. Senate. Dan Osborne said, you know, I might do that, but I won't do it as a Republican, and I won't do it as a Democrat. I will do it as a stone-cold independent who has objections to both parties. And so he's mounted this very populist campaign. He campaigns in union halls. He campaigns in community centers, driving thousands of miles across Nebraska in a truck with his picture on the side of it. And I can tell you that his economic positions are a stark critique of, you know, the power of corporations and the attacks on unions. He's very, very focused on that, and he has done remarkably well in connecting with working class people across Nebraska. Now, Nebraska is a pretty Republican state. Has a great Democratic Party that has, you know, pretty innovative leadership. Folks who are tied to Bernie Sanders, and so they've really built the party up a lot. But it's still a Republican state, by and large. And what Osborne has done, and I've seen him do it in meetings with groups of people, you know, he has spoken to, obviously, Democrats, but also he's spoken to Trump supporters. And he will sometimes disagree with them on some of the issues or some of the things they bring up. But he draws the conversation always back to those economics, that stark critique of corporations and of the harm they've done to working class people and the industrial setting, but also on farms. And the polling shows that he has closed the gap to a point where he could actually win this race.
As an independent in Nebraska. John, talk about what's happening here, where Democracy Now! Is in New York. People were floored a few years ago when one House race after another went to Republicans. It was a surprise upset. Talk about these congressional races and what they mean today in 2024.
Yeah, it's a wild thing that New York State, which is obviously a very, very Democratic state, could well tip control of the U.S. House of Representatives. And this is a big deal. It is true that in 2022, you saw a number of seats flip to the Republicans. Many of those seats remain competitive. And the real fascinating thing is that 2022 was an off-year election with a governor's race. This is a so-called on-year election with the presidential race. And you've covered very well the rally that Trump did at Madison Square Garden. That was seen in the national context. But remember, in New York, here was the former president of the United States and people around him, his supporters, saying incredibly brutal things about all sorts of constituency groups in New York State. This is a big deal. If, in fact, there is a big turnout of Democrats in New York State, not a competitive state, for Kamala Harris at the presidential level, that could have a real impact on 3, 4, even 5 congressional seats. What I'm looking at in the polling suggests that Democrats could pick up several seats in New York, as many, again, up to 5 if things go very, very well for them. That would very possibly tip control of the U.S. House of Representatives, because right now Republicans have a 3-seat majority. Democrats, really, because of redrawing of lines around the country, they need to pick up at least 5 seats, and obviously they want more. When I look around the country, New York is one of the 2 states where they could pick up, just in one state, they could pick up enough to flip control. The other is California. There's a number of competitive seats out there. It's very, very important to understand that the forced redrawing of lines in a couple of southern states, Alabama and Louisiana, has created 2 new seats in overwhelmingly black constituencies that could well elect Democrats. And then, you know, we could go around the country, Amy, but the fact of the matter is that Democrats are in reasonably good position to take the House of Representatives. And where you may see it happen is, as you suggest, in New York State.
Finally, John, you've written a piece on how Kamala Harris can win, her so-called closing argument, how Harris can win Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and the presidency. You write, Harris's closing argument should be about more than the fact that Trump sought to overturn the results of the 2020 election, has since embraced an increasingly authoritarian, even fascistic politics. It has to include a strong pro-choice appeal, loud defense of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Take it from there.
Well, what I believe strongly is that the Harris campaign, it has delivered some good messages about Trump, but they need to understand that at the doors, people want to talk about economics. I was with a guy named Steve Bauer out in Jefferson, Wisconsin, a real swing county, very competitive. This guy's been doing doors since May. I asked him just yesterday, what do you hear about at the doors? You know, what are you hearing? Do you hear about these democracy issues that are so important and that Steve thinks are super important? He says, well, you know, the truth of the matter is what I hear about is the economy. What I hear about is jobs and the impact of trade policies and things like that. And this is the bottom line, Amy. What I argued in my piece is that Kamala Harris actually has a good argument to make. Donald Trump, when he was president, restructured NAFTA and turned it into something else, created a new version of NAFTA, if you will. That has not worked well. Sean Fain, the leader of the United Auto Workers, refers to it as Trump's NAFTA and says it's been devastating for auto workers and other industrial workers across the country. I'm surprised that Harris hasn't put more emphasis on this in the closing days of the campaign, because the fact of the matter is economic issues are huge in this campaign. And there really is a way for Harris, who, by the way, voted against Trump's NAFTA, to deliver a powerful economic message. And I think if her campaign is smart in these closing days, they will dial up a lot of that economic messaging, because I do think that it is what people, especially at the doors in these battleground states, want to talk about.
John Nichols, want to thank you for being with us, the nation's national affairs correspondent. His latest piece, and we'll link to a lot of them at The Nation, Trump's not the only top Republican whose fascism is showing. He's going to be talking about, he in the article talks about House Speaker Johnson, and that's who we're going to talk about next. John, we hope to talk to you in the Election Night Special Democracy Now! Is doing. It's a four-hour Election Night Special, 8 to midnight. People can check it out. That's Eastern Time at democracynow.org and expanding to 2 hours on the morning after Wednesday, November 6th from 8 to 10. And any show, TV or radio station can take these broadcasts. Next up, what's that little secret between Trump and Johnson? We'll speak with Ellie Mistel about how Speaker Mike Johnson could help install Trump as president. Find out how. With an 80-year-old millionaire by Kirstie McCall. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with the nation's justice correspondent, Ellie Mistel, whose new piece out this week is headlined, That Little Secret Between Trump and Johnson? Here's what it could mean. It refers to a comment Trump made at his racist Madison Square Garden rally in New York last Sunday about how House Speaker Mike Johnson could help install Trump as a president through a contingent election in which the House, not the Electoral College, determines the president.
You know, with me, we got to get the congressman elected and we got to get the senators elected because we can take the Senate pretty easily. And I think with our little secret, we're going to do really well with the House, right? Our little secret is having a big impact. He and I have a secret. We'll tell you what it is when the race is over.
He and I have a secret. We'll tell you what it is when the race is over. And clearly, President Trump is concerned. Pieces in the Washington Post, Politico headline, Trump lagging an early vote with seniors in Pennsylvania, a red flag for GOP. For more, we go to Ellie Mistel. He is author of Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution. Ellie, welcome back to Democracy Now! Okay, what is this little secret?
Yeah, so it's really the 12th Amendment. One of the reasons you have to ask yourself, why is Donald Trump and his group of MAGA people stomping around the country, calling Puerto Ricans garbage, and generally acting like they don't need to get any more votes to win the presidency? And the reason why they think that they don't need any more votes is comes from the 12th Amendment. The 12th Amendment is where you get to these contingent election scenarios. What the 12th Amendment says is that the winner of the presidency is determined by whoever has a majority of the electoral votes among the electors appointed. Right? And that's the key phrase. If you do not get to a majority among the electors appointed, then you kick it to the House, and that's where you have the contingent election, where, importantly, the House votes based on its own state delegation. So basically, every state gets one vote. Currently, there are 26 delegations that are Republican, 24 Democrats, so Trump would win in that contingent election of the House. But that's not the secret. The secret is that if you decrease the number of electors appointed, right, the math is simple, that the majority of electoral votes that you need also goes down. So in a very simple case where we think it is, you need 270 electoral votes to win if there are 538 total electors. But if you take that number down to, say, 528 electors, well, then all of a sudden you only need 264 electoral votes to win, right? And you can do that. You can decrease the number of electors appointed if you prevent, delay, obfuscate the ability of any particular state to certify its elections and send electors to Congress by the statutorily required deadline of December 11th. And so, Amy, I think that's where this whole game is going to be played by Trump and Johnson. They're going to try to prevent states from submitting, states that Harris wins, from submitting valid states of slates of electors by the December 11th deadline. And then once we get to that deadline, Mike Johnson, as Speaker of the House and Republicans in control of the House, will simply call the process over and say any electors not appointed by the statutory deadline of December 11th simply don't count. And that is a way for Trump to steal an election that he loses.
And for people who are watching this globally, Ellie, for people who don't understand the Electoral College, and there are movements to change it, like the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, designed to ensure that the candidate who received the most votes nationwide as elected president would come into effect only when it could guarantee that outcome. What this system is that we have that they're finagling with right now?
Yeah, so for people who are not from America, who are, like, trying to figure out what's going on, I believe the scientific term for the Electoral College is stupid, right? The Electoral College is anti-democratic and dumb. If you're living in some other country and you have been told that America is the greatest democracy on earth, you have been sold a lie. We are not the greatest democracy on earth. We are not even a true democracy because of the Electoral College, right? The Electoral College, which has always been a part of our history, of our nation, it's always been part of the structure of the government, is fundamentally an anti-democratic system for the single elected official, the single representative that is supposed to be elected by all the people of the United States, right? Everybody else, it's based on their county, their town, their state. The president of the United States is the one official that's supposed to be elected by everybody, but he's actually elected by he or she one day, hopefully soon, is elected by nobody because of the Electoral College. It is a ridiculous system. It's an anachronistic system, basically, you know, like so much else in the Constitution, it's another one of those poison pills the enslavers put into the original Constitution in hope that it would make it very difficult for slavery to ever be outlawed in this nation. And while we overcame slavery, its fundamental structure of allowing for minoritarian white rule is still in place, and we still see the effects, and that's what we're looking at in this election. We got to remember, Donald Trump is most likely, you know, regardless of what happens on Tuesday in the Electoral College, Donald Trump is almost certainly going to lose the popular vote for the third time. For the third time in a row, this man will have a minority of the popular vote, yet still could be president either by winning the Electoral College outright or by gaming the system, as I've outlined in my piece in The Nation.
Tell us more about what you wrote about deadlines, that what this means is that Republicans just have to delay long enough to pass those deadlines. They don't have to win. They just have to stall. And we're seeing more and more across this country these complicated local election laws that have to do with counting. You know, we're doing an election special at night, an election special the next morning, when we very possibly might not know what the election results are, even the next morning.
Yeah, delay, delay, delay is the name of the game for the Republicans. Statutorily speaking, electors have to be submitted to Congress by December 11th. Statutorily speaking, those electors have to vote and then submit their votes on who the president should be by December 25th, Christmas Day, because we are that kind of stupid, right? January 3rd is when the new House takes office. That's a constitutional deadline, so no shenanigans are applicable there. And January 6th, as the violent MAGA people know, is the date when the House certifies the results of the Electoral College vote, But that date is largely ceremonial. Even Mike Pence understands that date is largely ceremonial. The real action is on between December 11th, when the electors are appointed, and December 25th, when they're supposed to be done voting. Now, those deadlines are statutory. That means they can be changed. And if you roll the tape back to 2020, when Nancy Pelosi is the Speaker of the House and the Democrats control the House, one would imagine that if states had gotten cute with their, you know, delaying submitting their slates of electors, Nancy Pelosi would have just extended the deadline. But this is why Speaker of the House Mike Johnson is critical to Trump's secret plan to steal the election. Because if Mike Johnson's in charge, which he absolutely will be, even if Democrats win the House, Mike Johnson's in charge on December 11th. If he's in charge, then he could not move the deadline, essentially, and declare the process over. Now, let's say Democrats win the House, right? Let's say January 3rd, Democrats come in, Hakeem Jeffries is the new Speaker of the House. Could the Democrats undo what Mike Johnson has done on December 11th and December 25th? Maybe, but as my colleague John Nichols just reminded us all, Democrats probably ain't going to control the Senate on January 3rd, so you generally need a bicameral proposition to move deadlines like that. You're probably not going to have the Senate, even if the Democrats win the House. But more importantly, and you know, people who know my beat will not be surprised about what I'm about to say, but if you set the deadline on December 25th, and on December 25th you say, okay, Trump is the president now because we didn't count the electors from Wisconsin and we didn't count the electors from Pennsylvania. Let's say that happens, right? Well, now Hakeem Jeffries comes in, we change the rules, whatever. That's called a lawsuit, right? And that ends up in front of the Republican-controlled Supreme Court, which we have already seen go to great lengths to protect Donald Trump, to protect his candidacy, and to protect his ability to become president again. So even if Jeffries and the Democrats win the House and take over on January 3rd, by then you're putting it all into, like, all roads lead to the Supreme Court, and the Republicans, MAGA Republicans and their wives, control the Supreme Court. So as I say in my piece, I mean, you're everybody likes to say, like, we're close to a constitutional crisis. Now, we in a constitutional crisis now, bro. And what happens after that, it's anyone's guess.
Ellie, you have an interesting piece in The Nation. Black men will vote for Harris. White men are the problem. I mean, I think a lot of the emphasis came when President Barack Obama started to appeal to black men. You say, why is the media talking so much about the fraction of black men who might go MAGA when more than 60% of white men will vote for Trump?
Yeah, I think the focus on black men has been a complete media, you know, red herring. Right. People have been worried about it. I saw a poll recently or post recently saying, like, it looks like Trump's support with black men could be evaporating. It was never there. All right. Trump is going to get the same black men to vote for him who voted for him last time, who voted for him in 2016, who voted for Mitt Romney in 2012, who voted for John McCain in 2008. He's going to get 10 to 15% of the black male vote because there are 10 to 15% of black males are Republicans, and they like Republican things, like shooting Liz Cheney, apparently. That's a Republican thing that apparently a lot of black men, that 15% of black men like, but that's it, and that's always it, and it's never more than that, right? Conversely, we live in a country where somewhere around 60% of white men will vote for the adjudicated rapist Donald Trump, and that is our problem in this country, not the 10 to 12 to 15% of black men who are going to vote Republican.
Ellie Mistal, we want to thank you for being with us, the nation's justice correspondent. We'll link to all your pieces, including that little secret between Trump and Johnson. Here's what it could mean. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM. Serving Kingston and its greater area proudly.
KPP Concerts and CFRC 101.9 FM present a stacked lineup of shows this November at the Broom Factory, featuring some of your favorite big-name acts and a few local gems. On November 1st, check out Canadian indie legend Destroyer live at Broom Factory with Fortunato Doretti Marnetti. On November 8th, don't miss Shania Twink, your favorite all-queer femme country and pop cover band. On November 20th, Canadian rock and roll powerhouse JJ Wild comes back to town. And on November 25th, hip-hop icon Classified with support from Rhea May take the stage at the Broom. For additional information and to buy tickets, visit kppconcerts.com. See you at the shows.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM. Your